Back together again for you Tuesday, January 6, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today. We open the show with the results of a new survey on just how many people are moving into and out of Connecticut and why. And why does the state consistently do poorly in these types of studies and others as well? Former FBI counterterrorism and counterintelligence operative Eric O'Neill dropped by to talk about the weekend operation to capture Nicolas Maduro and his wife in Venezuela. CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Nancy Cordes joined us to talk about the White House defense of last weekend's military action in Venezuela. Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio gave us her weekly update, while New Haven Independent reporter Paul Bass had even more details on the ouster of former New Haven Police Chief Carl Jacobson.
So, we've been told for years and years and years that one measure of how popular a place is or isn't to move to live to retire to get away from, to get your kids out of, to stop paying taxes, and either way, in or out, we've been told over the years that just look at what the moving van companies are saying. What are they booking? How many people from, say, State X are calling moving van companies saying, hey, we live in another part of the country and we're looking to relocate, so we want to come to, the new State X, or people in that already established State X, right? They say, well, we're leaving, whatever. We're leaving, we just want to. No, it's not because of work or whatever. We're leaving. Maybe sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But sometimes there's a scenario of, hey, we have to leave for whatever. So, we have heard about all these surveys that come out, and a bunch of companies do this. Now, understand, the first and foremost thing in a lot of these surveys is it gets the company or companies' names out there. It's how this business works, right? It's why you have corporate sponsorships for ballparks or whatever. But even though you may get a cheap sponsor mention in there, people do in those states that people are leaving from or coming to, people generally say, oh, geez, I didn't know that. So we have another one here, and this is an annual survey, and it generally comes out, about this time of the year, and it's interesting. And I'd like to get your thoughts on it as we're up and underway on this Tuesday right here, the 6th of January, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. The great state of Connecticut. Or as our dearly departed Governor William O'Neill used to say when I was out running after Governor O'Neill with a microphone, he'd say the state of Connecticut. It was one word, multiple syllables there. But old Bill would say the state of Connecticut. Connecticut slides. It drops one spot in the, get this, I know it's a cheap sponsor plug, but what the heck, the story's out there. Connecticut slides one spot in the U-Haul migration rankings for 2025. So we're doing one notch worse or poorer than we did in this last year. And I kind of find this interesting. I guess the U-Haul people, I think United Van Lines, are they still around? I think United Van Lines does one of these things too here. Connecticut dropped one notch in the annual U-Haul Growth Index. Connecticut ranks number 42. Hey, we're number 42. We're number 42. Doesn't quite have the ring that we're number one does. Ranked 42nd nationally as more residents moved out of state than moved in during 2025. Now, again, there's always a delicate balance here, but again, if more people move out than move in, you have a net population loss. That's not good. It's not good in a lot of reasons here, for a lot of ways, shapes, and forms here. Connecticut fell from 41st place in last year's survey, so now we're 42 out of 50. I don't know. Kind of sucks, don't you think? Connecticut fell from 41st place last year, keeping it in the bottom 10 states nationally. What a shock. Connecticut was last a net gain state, with more U-Haul customers arriving than departing in 2022. Yeah, but we're still in the lower percentage of the country. U-Haul customers arriving in Connecticut accounted for 49% of the one-way traffic in and out of state last year, 51% left. So you could say it's a split, 50-50, but for, you know, to be statistically honest, kind of isn't. We're kind of in the red ink of people here. Both arrivals and departures rose about 1% over the year. Now, Connecticut continues to do better than several other Northeast states. Massachusetts does worse. New York does worse. New Jersey does worse. And Pennsylvania does worse. California tumbles into the sea, as the great gods Becker and Fagan once said. California experienced the greatest net loss of residents for the sixth consecutive year. Now, you may wonder, who's gaining people, Paul? Well, I'm glad you asked. We'll talk about that coming up, and I'll ask the question here as we begin another frolic here on Connecticut Today. It's a simple question. Why does Connecticut rank so low? Why are we in the bottom 20% here in the last few years of people moving into the state? Why is it even a break-even proposition or people moving out? And I'll ask you, why can't we run and be a destination like some other states are? Because, again, I refer to my, and this is my home state, and I love it, and I've lived 99% of my adult life here. But, man, there's a lot of stuff we're good in, and a lot of stuff like costs and keeping people here and making it affordable. A lot of stuff, you know, we need an intervention here. We suck. We suck big time. We'll talk about that coming up right here on WICC. As you and I are together here, great to have you with us, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. It's Paul Pacelli here, Chris Williams behind the board there, and you and I discussing this. I guess there's a new U-Haul survey out there, and again, let's not pull any punches here. These things are out there in part to get the company's name out there, but they are interesting. U-Haul does one of these. United Van Lines does one of these. A net migration study. And again, year after year, we don't do really well here in Connecticut. Yes, we have some people that come in and live in the state. Mainly it's to relocate. Maybe they want to live in the Northeast. Culturally, they like it better, whatever. I don't know what the deal is there, but the bottom line is that we're either kind of a break-even state or we lose people, rather than states who do really well and actually get a lot more people moving in than moving out. Why is that? And I ask that somewhat rhetorically. We know what it is. All right, let's separate the weather out here, because weather may be a factor. But come on, the taxes in the state, what do we have, the second or third highest tax burden in this state? Utility costs, electric rates, and still we have no definitive plan. We have a bunch of blowhards in the Democratic majority in Hartford who bloviate and yet do nothing about affordable energy. And no, wind power is not affordable. It's expensive. And yet we have other states. Now, part of it is the weather. I get it. I understand that. Texas reclaiming the top spot after ranking second in 2024, becoming the leading growth state for the seventh time in 10 years. How about that? Think it now. Yes, maybe the weather is a part of it. Think it has something to do with taxes. You think it has something to do with lower regulation, you think? Something we'll never see here in Connecticut and will still continue to, not just this survey, every survey that comes out, whether it's costs, whether it's electricity, whether it's tax burdens, whether it's the burden to run a business, we suck. Doesn't mean it's a bad place. But see, this plays into my question. Whatever gets better here in the state? Nothing ever gets better to fracture a lot of people to say, hey, I've got to move to Connecticut. Now, yes, some people come here to do stuff at Yale and UConn and Quinnipiac and Sacred Heart and Fairfield. I get that. I understand that. The other big growth states, Florida, North Carolina, Tennessee, and South Carolina, rounding out the top five. Notable Connecticut growth markets. Now, there are areas of the state that do better here, according to U-Haul. Bristol, Colchester, Columbia, Danbury, Groton, Guilford, Hamden, Killingworth, on and on. New Britain, New Hartford, New London, Milford, how about that? Norwalk, Waterbury, Shelton, West Hartford, Windsor Lock. So U-Haul says those areas, those metro areas in Connecticut, by and large, are doing well. But the state is a break-even state. Why should we only be a break-even state? What can we do to fix this? Now, I know part of it is housing. We're going to have all this affordable housing now. Maybe that's it. But you don't think taxes has something to do with it? You don't think regulations have something to do with it? You don't think the cost of business has something to do with it? The company said, U-Haul said, 8 of the top 10 growth states are in the South. What a shock. While 8 of the bottom 10 are northern states. 7 of the top 10 growth states have Republican governors, while 9 of the bottom 10 have Democrat governors. How about that? When did we become two countries like this? Growing up, I knew there were differences, but I this is shocking now. When did we become essentially two separate countries? I know we're one country, and when push comes to shove, we unite around things. But man, oh man, the bipolar nature of the United States, it is amazing. Again, factoring weather out. Why do businesses love locating in the South? Or in the Midwest, or areas that seem more friendly to business? Why here in Connecticut, where we supposedly, we hear this all the time about what a great workforce we have there, yet we are annually in the bottom percentage of business-friendly states? Why is that? Are our leaders in Hartford and the State House and the State Senate, how are they so out of touch? Seriously. How are they so out of touch? Why is it not just Connecticut, but New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts? Why has it become that if you floated Connecticut or New York or New Jersey or even Pennsylvania to a major manufacturer who'd be looking at bringing in hundreds or thousands of jobs, if it's not a military manufacturer, God bless our military contractors here, but a private sector or publicly held, you know, blue-collar-based or white-collar-based company, why, if you floated Connecticut in front of a CEO or CFO, do they laugh? Do you think any major company, honestly, you think any major company, major manufacturer, somebody who could locate in Texas or the Carolinas or Tennessee or Louisiana or Mississippi, you think they would ever entertain the thought of coming to Connecticut, where at one time we were a manufacturing hub? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Well, Paul, you know, it costs a lot to make stuff in the Northeast and in blue states. Yeah, and that's my point, Einstein. Why does Connecticut continuously and continually price itself out of contention? Why don't we ever hear from Bob Duff, from Martin Looney, from Matt Ritter, from Jason Rojas, from the Democrats that control Hartford, and they have since the time of Jesus H. Christ? Why don't we ever hear those Democrats saying, hey, we want to make businesses, we want to make Connecticut more business friendly? Why do they never say that? Rhetorical question. I don't get it. I don't understand it. Help me out here. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Why is it always the Republican Party in this state that says we've got to make Connecticut more attractive? Our business taxes are nuts. Our business fees are nuts. Our electric costs are nuts. Why do we never hear that from the Democratic Party? Are they just happy being a 50-50 state? They must be. Maybe they're just happy trolling along. Been in the General Assembly since a few of them had breakfast with Abe Lincoln. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. All right, let's talk a little about Venezuela, shall we? What's up next? Our next guest is a cybersecurity expert, legendary FBI operative attorney. He founded the Georgetown Group and Nexenture AI. He began his career in the FBI as a ghost and undercovered field operative tasked to surveil foreign and domestic spies and terrorists. Another one of my guests that makes my life look and sound so meaningless. You've seen him on Fox News, CNN, CBS News. He's been in Newsweek. Eric O'Neill is the guest. Eric, it's Paul here in Connecticut. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good afternoon. Happy New Year. I'm doing well.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate it. Great to have you with us for a few minutes. All right, give us the high view there. What do they say, the 30,000-foot view? Before we get into the minutiae here, you saw what happened over the weekend on Saturday. You woke up, you saw all the reports, and you thought to yourself, what?
I thought that this was one of the most impressive intelligence-gathering operations paired with a kinetic and cyber assault that I've ever seen in recent history. This was a perfect execution of intelligence gathering on the ground by the CIA, who were required to go into Venezuela, which for them is a hostile country, mm-hmm. and put together what we call a pattern of life analysis on Maduro, know exactly where he was at any given time, and then help the military plan an operation that would allow the military to escort FBI agents into Venezuela to serve a warrant on Nicolas Maduro, the illegitimate president of the country, and arrest him and then extract him out of the country. It was an amazing operation that took just over 2 hours and was executed without the loss of any American life.
Eric, does this happen without the assistance of people in Venezuela, operatives, assets to help us? Did we have people or do we have people from your intelligence background who wanted this to happen, who may be in Venezuela, some Venezuelans themselves, and they helped us out with this, or was this strictly all us?
Well, there's actually evidence in some of the reporting from the administration, from the Trump administration, mm-hmm. that the CIA was able to find an asset very close, a covert asset very close to Maduro's inner circle.
Wow.
So that means that they had a source. They had someone who was helping. They were also using good old-fashioned surveillance. They were using very new modern drone surveillance and a lot of other techniques that the CIA can use to keep someone in pocket, is what we used to call it, mm-hmm. and keep track of them and know where they were going to be, their movements, so that they knew exactly where Maduro would be that evening when the military strike was authorized.
Eric O'Neill is the guest. So, Eric, not only did they have to physically go in and get Maduro and his wife, the first couple of Venezuela, but just getting there, too, and going in there, and what, they were able on a cyber level to take out air defenses and cause a blackout here? Did I read that right?
Yes, that's right. So that's what is one of the most extraordinary parts of this very new modern warfare that we're seeing. In order to send helicopters into the interior, and helicopters are very vulnerable, that you can shoot at a helicopter from the ground with a rifle. So in order to send helicopters in, they had to destroy or deny the use of all air defenses. Mm. At the same time, they used, I suspect, they haven't confirmed this, but there have been plenty of innuendo that the U.S. launched a cyber attack that turned the lights off in Caracas.
Wow.
So that there was a little bit of shock and awe as people's power went out, and denied them their early warning radar systems. Then over 150 aircraft from 20 different U.S. bases and ships and platforms launched a bombing and strike run that destroyed certain military assets in Caracas. So there was no ability to respond. And then that basically created a nice wide open corridor for helicopters to move into the interior, land Delta Force operatives and the FBI's hostage rescue team, which were the law enforcement officers who are authorized to serve a proper warrant, who showed up at Maduro's stronghold, took out his, a couple dozen Cuban heavy guards that were guarding him, and arrested him.
So this, Eric, really, I mean, it sounds like, and I've had some other experts on to tell me this, and they're saying a lot of the same stuff you are, including some military veterans. This is, with all due respect to the fine men and women involved in this thing, the planning, the execution, not to make fun of this, but this almost does sound like something I would see at a Saturday night or Saturday morning movie there up on the big screen with all this special ops stuff and dark ops and Navy and Army SEALs. So really, if we were to watch this, I guess you're talking about something that what Americans were always told could happen and does happen. And I guess that's what we looked at.
I think that's certainly true. I actually, in some writing earlier, I put it in terms of something you'd read in a Tom Clancy novel or a Brad Thor novel, right? But the fact is that one beneficial aspect of the operation is that we've demonstrated to primarily Russia and China the true extent of our prowess militarily. Not only that, but our ability to gather intelligence in a country that was seeded with Chinese and Cuban and Russian intelligence officers right under their nose and launch a strike. So I think that it shows the world or our adversaries that they might not want to take us on in a military conflict.
Eric O'Neill is the guest. Eric, could we do the same thing with your background and your opinion of what you know and have seen over the years? If this were, say, Cuba in Havana, or if this was Colombia in Bogota, could we do the same thing, or are those completely different types of scenarios that would have to be planned for?
There are different types of scenarios that would have to be different planning. But yes, if we wanted to remove the president of Colombia, we certainly could do it. I don't think geopolitically that would be a sound thing to do. I think that this does provide a warning to the president of Colombia, who, you know, the Trump administration has accused of shipping cocaine into the United States. I suspect that, you know, these other countries will toe the line. What I do think in regards to Cuba is that the removal of Venezuela from the playing board in support of Cuba, and they have been funding Cuba to the tune of billions. They keep their energy afloat. They basically are providing them an economy. Cuba is going to be in a lot of trouble right now, and this could hasten a collapse of the regime there in Cuba.
Interesting. Our guest's book, his latest book, by the way, Spies, Lies, and Cybercrime, Cybersecurity Tactics to Outsmart Hackers and Disarm Scammers. Intelligence analyst, intelligence agent, and cyber tech expert, Eric O'Neill. Eric, thank you. Appreciate it. And hopefully we can talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely, Paul. I appreciate being on the show, and everybody stay safe out there.
Thank you, Eric. Eric O'Neill. All right, so what's next in Venezuela? What's the White House saying? Do they know? Joining us right now is a person you see a lot of times nightly on the CBS Evening News, because she is the CBS News Chief White House Correspondent. Always great to have Nancy Cordes with us. Nancy, good afternoon. Happy New Year. How are you?
I am great, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much. And I guess the kind of the theme we're seeing today is everybody is asking the White House, like, okay, The operation was slick. It looked like a Tom Clancy movie. This was okay. Brad Thor would like this, but now what's next here? Is that what we're worried about?
Lots of questions about that. The answers that we are getting tend to run along the lines of, the entire U.S. government is poised to work on this. We have working groups. We have, an all-of-administration approach here, from the Secretary of State to the Secretary of Defense. But when we ask for more specifics about, okay, so what does that actually mean? What does it mean when the president says we're running Venezuela? Are you actually doing that? That's when we get fewer specifics. And it's not just reporters. Today, the Senate's Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, said that in the roughly two-hour briefing that top lawmakers got yesterday from Rubio and other officials, he said that when they asked things like, you know, are you going to be sending in troops? How long do you expect this to last? How much will it cost? He said that they weren't getting very many specifics, and his concern was that this was sort of a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants situation where even the officials that were talking to them weren't sure either.
And Nancy, finally, from what I read, and I'm sure you're getting the buzz here too, I guess there's a dynamic now, right? We're not sure as to this Delcy Rodriguez, who was sworn in. Like, who is she playing ball with? Is she going to do right what the White House says? Does she have her own aims here? She's a wild card in this too, isn't she?
Sure. And White House officials insist that they've got a lot of leverage over her and other Venezuelan officials. There is still a quarantine in place, around the coastline of Venezuela, preventing oil ships from coming in and leaving. And the president himself has threatened that if she doesn't do what the U.S. wants, then she's going to face an even more dire threat than Maduro did. On the other hand, if she doesn't show the Venezuelan people that she is there for them and that she is still working in lockstep with the regime, then she could face unrest at home. So it's a very delicate situation in Venezuela, and it helps to explain why U.S. oil companies are kind of approaching this all with a lot of caution, because they don't want to sink billions of dollars into a situation that is still very unstable.
CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Nancy Cordes. Nancy, as always, thanks for your time. We appreciate it, and take care. We'll talk. Thanks.
You got it.
Thanks, Nancy. Appreciate it. Also, New Haven in the news here, along with my friend Megan Portfolio from the Hartford Portfolio, YankeeInstitute.org. A little union strong-arming, Ms. Portfolio in New Haven. Is that what we have here? Good afternoon. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Paul. So we have, well, it's more so this is Hartford, again, like trying to like stick their nose into local affairs.
Shocking.
And this is like
I'm stunned.
Case study on why they shouldn't be.
I'm stunned, Megan. Really? Wow.
Yeah. It literally took maybe about 5 seconds after the ball dropped for me to get annoyed with our government.
Okay, so what are you highlighting here? What's going on?
So in the right before the holidays, the New Haven Teachers Union announced that contract negotiations were coming to a stall and that they were going to go through arbitration.
Okay.
And one of their major sticking points was the rising cost of health care.
All right.
They're saying that it's not keeping up with their wage increases. So now it's going to arbitration.
Okay.
One of the things that they want to do is, instead of being part of the city's healthcare system, they want to join this state-run employee municipal program. It's called the partnership program. And the partnership program, they actually just released a report. It's minus $18 million right now because they're essentially paying out more claims than what they're taking in.
There's a shock.
So the union wants to be part of this system.
Okay.
Well, Mayor Elicker is like, we can't afford it.
Yeah.
So now this is a local issue. This is between the union and the city.
Okay.
So Hartford decides that they're going to stick their nose in this mess.
Shocking.
And the New Haven Federation of Teachers posted on Facebook that they held a Zoom call, and the entire New Haven delegation sat in on this call. And it wasn't a listening session. Yeah. This was like an active session. And in the Facebook post, they wrote that the lawmakers weren't just there to listen, but they actually agreed with the union's position and are committed to work ahead to make those demands a reality.
Shocking. I'm stunned. I'm absolutely
stunned. This is the problem, though, Paul.
Yeah.
These guys in Hartford are the ones that create all of these mandates that are unfunded that make it impossible for cities like New Haven to operate. I mean, New Haven's got a huge school system, a huge police department. I guess they need a new police chief now. And they have a lot of services. So when the mayor's telling you we don't have the money for this, they don't have the money for it. And the only way to get the money for it is either A, raise taxes, or raise the premiums for all of the other city employees, or beg for money from Hartford, and that leaves the rest of the state picking up the tab
and
for
New
Haven's mess.
Yeah, and I'm sure during this informational Zoom call, Megan Portfolio, there wasn't any thought exchanged of, hey, you know, there's elections coming up in November, and I'm not accusing anybody of saying this, but if I'm a legislator, right, and they're staring down these New Haven school officials, right, they're all sitting there, Megan, you know, the New Haven delegation going, yeah, these people vote. Yeah, I guess I know which way I'm going to have to come down on this one, right?
And you know what? And again, that's a you problem, not a me problem. This is a New Haven problem. I'm not sticking my nose into their mess.
Yeah.
It's something that they need to work out with the teachers.
Yeah.
Do the teachers have a valid point? Yes, they do. Does the city have a valid point? Yes, they do. Those two parties need to come to terms with that. This is why collective bargaining at the local level, it's designed this way because it's the local officials that are at the supermarkets, at the gas station, that are actually accountable to the taxpayers in the city. The guys from Hartford, the guys and gals from Hartford, they're coming in, sweeping in, trying to look like the big heroes. They're going to get the applause, but they're not the ones that have to clean up the mess. They're not the ones that are going to have to tell the residents of New Haven that their taxes are going to go up because of this decision, if they decide or if the arbiters decide to allow the teachers to join the partnership plan.
Yeah, and who's going to get yelled at? The Board of Alders in New Haven, the finance director, right? And Mayor Elicker, he's going to get yelled at, as any other mayor would be, whether it's a mayor Ganim in Bridgeport or the mayor of Hartford or Waterbury. It's like, wait a minute, whose side are you on here? And you're right, the Board of Alders or city councils, they get the flack well before any mayor does.
Yeah, and Hartford's lawmakers shouldn't be picking sides at all in a situation like this. Again, this is a local issue between labor and City Hall, and that's where it needs to get resolved.
All right, folks, check it out. Megan Portfolio's latest. You can check this out and everything else, back columns as well, YankeeInstitute.com, the Hartford Portfolio. So you have kind of a situation here in New Haven where the schools, the teachers union wants one thing. Mayor Elicker is not happy. The Board of Aldermen kind of sitting around watching what happens. The finance director, and then the New Haven delegation comes swooping in. So interesting times in my native Elm City. Now, I hear that the dog might have been a little bit of a bad boy. Did I get that? Did I hear that right for Christmas?
Oh, he's been a very bad boy. He's a very bad boy at Christmas. He was running around the house, causing mass chaos.
Yeah.
Like, children were screaming
because
he's just running around as fast as he can. It was hysterical. People are chasing. It was like a cartoon. They're chasing him around the house, trying to get him back downstairs, which he eventually did go. But I did go to the Cape for the last week of the year just to get a little relaxation in before the craziness of session starts.
Well,
and he was wonderful.
Oh, yeah. I knew I wanted to ask you something before I let you go. When does the session start?
February, I'm going to say 4th, 8th. I don't know off the top
okay,
of my head.
Okay, no, so we got session. We got February, March, April, short session. So you know, obviously the bad stuff is done in the odd years before there's an election. They want people to forget. Is there anything, before I let you go, is there anything you hear of that is going to be like issue one? Are they ready to blow more things
up? There's a lot of issues, and the progressives are very bold in right now, especially with what with the, you know, the new New York City mayor.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to scoop myself, because that's actually going to be my column on Friday. But there's a bunch of environmental stuff that's coming out that's not going to be good for energy prices. There's a bunch of labor stuff coming out.
Okay.
They need to figure out this whole SNAP and Medicaid situation.
Oh, yeah.
So they're thinking they need to, you know, pay for that. But there's a lot of stuff. And possibly a way to resolve the issue with the special transportation fund, which they're saying is, you know, losing a lot of money, and they're going to need to, they call it revenue, but you know what that means, either tolls or increased taxes.
Well, Megan, you know what? A lot of red states and blue states, if you go online, and you, I'm meaning people, I know you know this, a lot of red and blue states, so it's kind of a bipartisan thing. They say, well, okay, if you're driving an EV, you're not paying gas taxes, so you will pay, if you choose to drive that EV, which you're heavier on the roads, you will pay a yearly fee because you're getting away scot-free. I wonder if they'll have the guts to do that.
I don't know, but I've written about that before, and I've made that point. And not that I'm ever advocating for any increased costs to taxes. I mean, we pay enough in this state, but I mean, people, and no offense to the EV people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your choice to drive the car, but there are like free riders on the highways, so they're not having to pay all the gas taxes that we have to pay.
All right, Megan Portfolio. Megan, have a great week, and we'll chat next time, okay?
Have a great week, Paul.
All right, Megan Portfolio. Check it out at theyankeeinstitute.org. Quite the story still unfolding in my hometown of New Haven. Chief Carl Jacobson, the police chief there, who by all accounts had been doing a pretty decent to solid job there. Suddenly, about 24 hours ago, the city and the mayor there, Justin Elliger, making the announcement that Chief Jacobson, now former Chief Jacobson, was out of a job, and some of the best reporting on this done by the New Haven Independent. I tell you about this site all the time, newhavenindependent.org. It was started by a buddy of mine, Paul Bass, years ago. He got the thing up and running, now is going back to his roots as a reporter. And Paul Bass joins us here to detail this story that has got some fresh new info that was posted just minutes ago. Hey, Paul, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
Hey, Paul, it's great to hear you, man. How you doing?
Good. I'm doing good. And Paul, God bless you and the staff there at the Independent, still doing really good journalism here, digging deep. And boy, what a story here. This broke about 24 hours ago, and now you sent me something here with a new twist here. So explain to people who aren't in the greater New Haven area the kind of the background with Chief Jacobson and now what's happened to him.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those tragic stories. As you pointed out, Paul, he's a beloved police chief. He rose through the ranks. He was completely non-ideological, non-political, was fair to everybody, made a lot of big arrests, and also cared about people who got in trouble and helped get their lives back on track. In fact, right before he resigned, he was about to announce a program with a former police critic to train people arrested in the Kia Boys, car thefts, to do car repair.
Wow.
But he screwed up. He admitted that he was dipping into the confidential informant fund. That's cash that's in a safe on the desk of usually an assistant police chief in the police department to pay confidential informants. And we had a history in New Haven of scandals where high-ranking cops were dipping into that fund. So in 2008, we did a whole procedure written with top police experts from the country on how to put guardrails so those thefts couldn't happen. Then it turned out that the chief apparently was dipping in. We don't know how much yet. They're not telling us much of the city. They're being very secretive. And apparently that policy they had in place completely fell apart because the chief wasn't even supposed to be having access to that money. That money was supposed to be on the desk of an assistant police chief in charge of investigations. And he and the person who's in charge of intelligence were supposed to be the only people who knew who the confidential informants were. They're supposed to fill out paperwork every time they got money. They're supposed to document the money. They're supposed to keep a limited amount of money in the safe at any one time. And then only that assistant chief was supposed to give out the cash. We can't even get a straight story about whether the assistant chief even knew about the cast. And in fact, here's the twist, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Mayor Elicker named as the acting chief the assistant chief who was supposed to be minding the store. So there's no evidence that anyone else stole any money, including that guy. He's very honest. But obviously there was a breakdown. The person directly responsible for that breakdown is the person the chief just put, the mayor just put in charge of the department at a moment of scandal, the guy at the center of the scandal. The mayor won't talk about it except to say, we can't, you know, that whole blanket, we can't comment on ongoing investigation.
Oh, yeah.
Then they tell you all sorts of stuff that they want to tell you, but not the stuff they don't want to tell you. And anything they don't want to tell you would jeopardize it. But anything they do want to tell you, of course, is fine because it serves their purposes. So he won't tell us. And this guy's very respected, too. But he won't tell us what his thinking was, that he would put the person at the center responsible for watching that money. He did tell us, because this served his purposes, that the assistant chief confronted the chief when he found out. Somebody else discovered it, told the assistant chiefs, and then this guy confronted the chief, who then allegedly confessed, because he's a good guy. He doesn't want to put the department through turmoil. He had a mistake. But we're not getting the full story. And at these moments, as you know, Paul, because you've covered, as I have over the decades, these scandals in New Haven Police Department, which is not different from other departments. All departments have this.
Mm-hmm.
We know how important it is to tell the public why you're making decisions and on what basis. And to hide behind a partial release of information and that we're supposed to trust them, that they're choosing based on what's best for the public rather than what's best for them, is not very reassuring.
Paul Bass joining us from the New Haven Independent. Paul, I'm intrigued to find out, because I always kind of thought this went on, but I didn't know there was a structure here for the paid informant money. Now, I know you said that they're not telling you how much. I get that. I understand it. But do we have any idea of how much, like, did they pay
out on a
yearly basis?
We're obviously hearing figures. We're hearing it was not a one-time thing, it was just a little bit of money. We're hearing this, that one thing they won't tell us, which has had nothing to do with jeopardizing an investigation, based on my reporting today, I do not feel confident saying that that safe was even in the assistant chief's office where it was supposed to be. I am not confident saying that years haven't been going by where they've completely ditched these guardrails and this policy, so that this old problem, because we used to have this problem where everyone just dipped into that fund all the time, and one guy was accused and arrested for stealing tens of thousands of dollars.
Wow.
And but it was more like, you know, you take out 100, one guy described to me today who was involved in the investigation before, you know, you take out 130, you keep 60, give the guy 70, and there was never paperwork. And then they set up, but now what kind of paperwork is there going to be that the chief was just allegedly putting his hand in the till, and the people who were supposed to watch the money weren't even around the money?
Wow. Folks, check it out. I'm sure there's more to come here. Fascinating story. Of course, for this and more, newhavenindependent.org. Hell of a report on my longtime buddy, Paul Bass. Paul, thanks, and as soon as you have something new, we'll have you back on here. Thank you, my friend.
Right back at you. Thanks, Paul.
Appreciate it. There you go, Paul Bass. Wow, did you guys just hear that? Talking about, and again, we don't want to accuse the chief is gone. They'll figure out his retirement, any criminal charges. But listen, you always cops would tell me all the time, sometimes nobody wants to talk unless we give them somebody, but thousands of dollars, who is that, a budget item? Wow.